Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York, and WOOS 98.9 FM, Schenectady, New York, broadcasting live from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Today, Francine Gordon of the Capital Region West Indian Association joins us live in the studio.
And today, and then a new episode of the Triple E's with Monica Roach of the American Heart Association.
And later on, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry reports from the Schenectady County Public Library.
After that, we go to the Collar Works to see Art Stands Still.
And finally, we close with the show with author Eric Blanc at Red State Revolt, a forum hosted by the Democratic Socialists of America.
Okay, so let's go to some rapid-fire headlines. On Wednesday, a forum for Cajole's mayoral candidates resulted in a hot debate between embattled incumbent Sean Morse, former state police major William Keeler, and councilman... Council.
Got to turn your phone off before the show, Bosch.
How about that? Yeah, that's my grandson calling for ice cream, you know? Yeah. Councilman Steve Knappler and former city treasurer Peter Frandl, a new 100 witness tough questions about Morse's current indictments, the city's closure of its popular community center, and public safety questions, according to a Times Union report. A second forum is scheduled for 6:30 p.m. Thursday at the Cajoles High School.
U.S. Representative Paul Tonko of Amsterdam addressed the ongoing climate crisis in a Tuesday evening town hall with constituents at Hudson Valley Community College, according to the Troy Record. The chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Environment and Climate Change said, quote, Americans are living and dying in the path of unprecedented flooding, raging wildfires, and battering storms driven by Earth's changing climate. He also pointed out the federal government's inability to take climate crisis action seriously, with reference to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's report that global carbon emissions must be brought down by 45% from the 2010 level by 2030.
Albany County Public Library Executive Director Scott Jarosimek released talking points about the recent decision to close the North Albany YMCA, which also houses a library branch. The library will remain open. Jarosimek noted, based on a memorandum of understanding between the Albany schools and the library, the Y's future in the city is undetermined.
SUNY Polytechnic Institute founder Elaine Calleyeros and former top aide to Governor Cuomo Joe Percoco filed separate appeals Wednesday seeking to overturn last year's convictions on federal corruption charges. Calleyeros was convicted by a jury in July 2018 for rigging $855 million in bids for state contracts. Percoco was convicted of taking $300,000 in bribes from upstate developers who had business before the state.
The city of Troy is planning a new trail with access to the riverfront. Trojans were able to get a preview of the proposed trail at a meeting on Tuesday. The proposed trail would connect Riverfront Park to the proposed trail north of Green Island Bridge. Up to the Headley Building, city leaders and neighbors agree it would be a great addition to Troy. A state grant would take care of nearly half of the $1.1 million price tag. The city is aiming to have the bid ready by the end of June.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York has yet to reach the fundraising threshold of 65,000 individual donors that would secure her a spot at the first presidential debates hosted by the Democratic National Committee. Gillibrand must achieve 65,000 individual donations across 20 states or 1% support in three separate polls in order to make it to the debate stage. That's according to new rules barring DNC superdelegates from voting in the first primary ballot.
The Daily Gazette reports that the Capitol Repertory Theater of Albany, part of Schenectady-based Proctors, has finally secured the historic tax credit it needs as part of a financing package to compete in the $9.5 million renovation of a former 1860s warehouse on the North Pearl Street, four blocks from the home of four decades. The company is looking to move into its new home next year. The holdup came when a first attempt from the tax credits was turned down because of the theater is looking to have raked seating inside. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And to learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, go to mediasanctuary.org. And if you have questions, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Monica Roach, stroke ambassador to the Capital Region Heart Walk and Run, joins us in the studio to tell us her survival story and a bit about being a professional cellist and working with the Empire State Youth Orchestra.
Hello again, everyone. This is H. Bosch Jr. of the Triple E segment, Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. Today's guest is Miss Monica Roach of the American Heart Association. Hello, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much, Miss Monica, for taking time out your busy schedule and blessing us with an interview. Okay. And amazing story, so we're going to just dig right in. Can you share your story with us,
Monica? Oh, sure. Actually, it was almost precisely 2 years ago this week. I was home with my kids for the April break, and I had come out of the shower preparing to go to a dear friend's funeral. And then I noticed that my hand felt a little odd. And then I started to feel a little tired, unnormally tired. And I went to lie down in my room, sent the kids to go do whatever. And then as I tried to get up, I was not able to stand. I fell directly to the floor, and I knew what was happening.
You knew it?
I knew.
Wow. Well,
yeah.
That's good, because that's half the battle. Most people don't know what's going on.
Yeah, that is true. And I called for my son and asked him to please call for someone to come help. So he did. He called 911. My daughter called my husband to tell him what was going on, to ask him to come home, through a lot of tears, but she made it. And luckily, I was able to get help very, very quickly.
To God be the glory. So why did you agree to be a stroke ambassador? And I thank you for it. The difference you're making is just priceless.
Well, thank you. Thank you. When I was asked to be a stroke ambassador, I was extremely flattered. There was no way I could say no. To me, that just felt like something that I had an obligation to do. I was lucky enough to have survived and to flourish. And I figured since I had to share that.
Well, you know what that is. That was God's grace and favor upon you, you know?
It was.
And, you know, That's when things like that happen, you know, God's grace and favor, or people may not be able to see this, but his favor was leaning towards you.
That's true.
Right?
That's
I'm going to say it again. His favor was leaning towards you. Okay. So what are the signs of a stroke?
Well, they're pretty straightforward. Although I, from what I understand, it's not always 100% this way, but most of the time it's a matter of remembering FAST, F-A-S-T. The F is for face drooping. The A is for arm weakness. The S is for slurred speech. And the T is very important. It's for time to call 911.
Wow.
And thankfully my kids did that.
Say that again.
Yes.
I like that.
It's FAST, face drooping, arm weakness, slurred speech, and most importantly, time to call 911.
So here's something a lot of listeners may want to know that don't know. Who is most likely to be affected by stroke?
Well, frankly, everyone is. But primarily, we're looking at a high concentration in the African-American community.
I'm glad you pointed that
out. Yes, it's double the rate for the risk of stroke. Well, part of it is just
Genetics
and
diet.
Some is diet. That's mm-hmm. true. Mm-hmm. And when you put those two things together, it's hard to escape being the number one
victim.
It's almost
combustible.
Yeah. Yes. It really mm-hmm. is. And it's something that we all need to be aware of mm-hmm. and something that we do need to check.
Well, how can people prevent a stroke?
Well, there are some steps to prevention that are fairly easy to follow. You want to manage your blood pressure. Mm-hmm. That's critical. And know what your blood pressure is if it's high. The ideal blood pressure is 120 over 80 or less. And mm-hmm. high blood pressure puts you at risk for stroke. So you want to eat well, lots of lean protein, vegetables, mm-hmm. fruits, whole grains, etc. A
lot of cardio.
Oh, yeah. Right? Exercise regularly, and the mm-hmm. cardio is really beneficial. Mm-hmm. The American Heart Association recommends 150 minutes per week. Mm-hmm. You want to manage your stress. You don't ever want to smoke. And if you do, you want to quit. Mm-hmm. Know your numbers. Know that blood pressure.
And let's highlight on the number factor when mm-hmm. you say know your numbers.
Oh, yeah. You want to know what your blood pressure is. Mm-hmm. You want to know that 120 over 80 is considered good. And you want to know, hey, my blood pressure is 180 over 78. You know, that's important. Mm-hmm. We also want to know our cholesterol. Our BMI, which is not one of my favorites, but mm-hmm. it's an important one. Mm-hmm. All of those things together. And if they're high, it's okay. Just make a plan with your doctor to treat them. Mm-hmm. That's the most important thing.
So let me ask you this, staying on this part of the interview. What were some of the good things you were doing when you had your stroke? And what were some of the bad things you were doing?
Well, some of the good things
were you exercising? Yeah. Were you eating? You know, let's speak on that a little bit.
Well, honestly, I weighed a good deal, much more than what I weigh now. Mm-hmm. So my eating habits weren't very good, but I did exercise from time to time. Mm-hmm. I did eat some healthy foods. I was not always eating the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. But I would eat the wrong thing a little too frequently, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I never met a sweet potato pie I didn't like.
And they love me.
How about that they call my name in the middle of the night with a cold glass of milk? But anyway, I digress.
Oh, yeah.
All right?
Oh, yeah.
So then tell me a little bit about your personal life, all right? Where you from? You know, your upbringing, you know, family life. Yeah.
Originally, I'm from Toledo, Ohio.
Okay.
And we moved here.
And you were early to date?
Well, that's not always the case.
Tip your waiter, folks. I'll be in the area all week.
Yes.
Try the veal.
That's not always a common occurrence. That's
okay.
true.
Okay.
But I am from Ohio.
Right. Family life?
Yeah. Well, I'm married with two beautiful children, my son Avery and my daughter Peyton.
Shout out. Okay.
Yes, you know it always. Mm-hmm. Both fantastic musicians, I have to mention.
Oh, really? And
yes.
What do they play?
My son plays the cello just like I used to.
Yes, and that's what I wanted to say. Mm-hmm. You're an accomplished cello.
I used
played
to
all over the world?
Yeah.
Wow.
I did.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I'm working.
See my engineer lighting up now.
Mm-hmm. I'm working my way to recapture some of that's been lost. My facility has gone down. The left side of my body was affected by the stroke, mm-hmm. but I'm starting to regain some of my my abilities.
So formal education for music.
Mm-hmm.
You went to school for music?
No, actually, I went to school for psychology. Yeah,
wow.
At SUNY Albany.
Amazing.
A little while ago.
Yeah.
But I ended up pursuing
music.
Is
that what brought you to the Capital District?
No, actually, I moved here when I was almost 10 with my family.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But I did go to school here at SUNY and, you know, had a wonderful experience. But yeah, music just wouldn't let go. It just kept calling me.
How about that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, before we close out, I want to ask, tell us a little bit about this Heart Walk on June 22nd. And I am going to make it my business to be there.
Actually, the Heart Walk is June 2nd.
June 2nd. Okay,
yep.
June 2nd.
Yep.
Okay.
And it's a very exciting event. I'm looking forward to it myself. I haven't attended, but I will be this year.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have all kinds of events going on, starting early in the morning with the walk itself and some other events as the day progresses. And it really is going to be quite an experience. It begins at 8:30 in the morning.
Okay.
It's a 3-mile walk.
And how many people do you anticipate?
Oh, I think we're supposed to get around 3,000 people.
Okay. And I think your good friend, Cindy Applebaum's going to be there?
Yeah, from what I hear.
Okay.
Yes,
okay.
A new friend, but a dear friend.
Okay, gotcha. And I'm sure Catherine McCarthy, your good friend, is going to be there.
Oh, okay. She'll definitely be
and
there.
And shout out to her, mm-hmm. you know, for all the work she's doing and just being so, so helpful in letting us connect and giving me the opportunity and pleasure to bring awareness and exposure to this great event. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I appreciate you, Ms. McCarthy, for all you do. Yes.
Oh, yeah. She is such an amazing woman who has endless energy to devote to this.
Right. Mm-hmm. I agree. So then tell us how people can reach the American Heart Association and all those other things that, you know, how can they get connected and get involved before we close out?
Well, that's really easy.
Okay.
If you have any questions about anything to do with the Heart Association, heart health, or the upcoming festivities, you just go to heart.org and ask anything that you can think of.
Okay. Great. Well, I'm just going to say thank you for taking time out your busy schedule. You are a true, true difference maker, and you have a calling on your life, and you are stepping up to the plate and accepting that calling, you know?
Well, thank you.
You are, you're a type of person that turned a setback into a setup for a comeback. And you are really changing lives because of it. So God bless you. Continued success. And I'm going to close out. As I always say, I appreciate everything you've done. Appreciate everything you're doing. And I appreciate everything you will continue to do. And
well,
don't be a stranger.
You. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you are so, so welcome. Okay. So until next time, folks, it's about the triple E's. Education, empowerment, entrepreneurship. And remember this, don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy sitting between two high-powered women, Miss Cindy Applebaum and Miss Monica Roach, saying, I'm doing what I'm made to believe.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
Okay, our next guest is two young ladies in the studio, and we start with Francine Gordon, co-founder and vice president, and Allison Joseph, treasurer of the Capital Region's West Indian Association. They are in studio today to talk about this Saturday's Health and Wellness Festival held at Jennings Landing in Albany. Welcome to the show, ladies.
Thank you for having us.
Okay,
thank
and
you.
Should I say young ladies?
Absolutely.
Okay, so let me dig right in then. When was the Capital Region West Indian Association founded and why?
The Capital Region West Indian Association was founded last year, actually the summer of 2018. And basically we founded this association, like we say in our mission statement, to unify people of, you know, West Indian descent, businesses that focuses on West Indian, you know, product and things of that nature. So we wanted to bring more of our culture and heritage to the forefront of the Capital Region.
Okay, so the mission statement basically is? Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So what are the areas of the Capital Region do you primarily serve?
We serve the entire Capital Region, Albany, Schenectady, Saratoga.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay. And how was the organization, or how has the organization been received by the Capital Region's community, Ms. Joseph?
We've actually been well received in the Capital Region. We've had, I believe in February, we had our Soca Explosion event. And people were so excited about it, and everyone was asking us to do more events. So it's a lot of times people from the Caribbean and the West Indies are in the community, but they've pretty much assimilated into the culture. Mm-hmm. So we don't know that they're here. So now now this is our way of getting everybody out and having the culture represented.
Okay.
So tell us some of the impacts that you've had in our Capital Region community and about this event and what you're hoping to achieve, your event, Just for the Health of It.
I think we're going to go to you, Ms. Gordon.
OK, okay, the impact and what we're trying to achieve with Just for the Health of It. Basically, as what Allison was saying, when we did our Soaker Explosion, it was very well received. And we noticed that, you know, a lot of our programs, especially that was geared towards, you know, physical wellness. So, you know, after brainstorming, we thought doing Just for the Health of It, which is a health and wellness festival that focuses on the seven dimensions of wellness. We wanted, you know, just to bring everyone together, do more things to bring awareness so that, you know, we as a community, especially people from the West Indies and beyond, can be more in tune with themselves as far as with wellness, whether it's financial, physical, occupational, environmental. And basically, we wanted to do seven dimensions of wellness because everything, you know, it's well-rounded. Everything is connected to each other. So that's why we decided to make that, you know, the focus of the festival.
So tell us why you decided to do a health fair. What is the need in the community?
Well, in the community as a whole, obviously, health and wellness is important, but it is especially important in the Caribbean communities because often a lot of issues don't get addressed, whether there are cultural differences, language barriers, just disconnected from resources. So I felt that it was important for us to do this type of event so that we can bring those resources to the community so that people know their options and their resources available to them.
Oh, great, great. So what's the organization and vendors, what can they expect to see at the event?
Organization and vendors that will be at the event. We have a variety of vendors. Like we said, we decided we want to focus on all dimensions of wellness. So okay. There'll be people there from, you know, financial wellness, occupational, and we're going to have some food vendors such as, you know, D&M Jerk Center for people that, you know, love Caribbean food. We're also going to have CDPHP.
Wow.
And also, yeah, places like that. Also Hudson Valley. And we're going to be having Mission Accomplished Transition. Fidelis Care is also going to be there. The Focus Churches of Albany. So we're trying to have a very well-round variety of vendors that focuses on all dimensions. So not just one, you know, one topic, not just physical, but everything.
So can you talk a little bit more about the National Caribbean American Heritage Month? Wow, that sounds really interesting. And Ms. Joseph, would you like to address that?
Sure.
Okay.
So June is National Caribbean American Heritage Month. And National Caribbean Heritage Month, during Caribbean American Heritage Month, we honor America's long shared history with our neighbors in the Caribbean and celebrate the Caribbean Americans who have enriched this nation.
Okay.
So what we are trying to do here in the Capital Region is to bring this to the forefront. Often in some of the larger cities, New York City, Atlanta, and these places, they highlight it and they celebrate it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more impact on, you know, about that. Here in the Capital Region, not so much. So we're trying to bring this to the forefront and have people recognize that people from the Caribbean are here.
Great.
And we have been contributing and will continue to be contributing to the area.
So what do you hope they walk away with at this event?
We're hoping that people walk away knowing more about our culture and our heritage.
Okay.
So that's what we're trying to do. We love our culture. We love our heritage. So we want to know more about our culture and heritage, and that's why we formed this association because, you know, people from the West Indies are not just from one part, whether it's from Jamaica, you know, Haiti. We want to learn, as a Jamaican myself, I want to learn more about other, you know, cultures within the West Indies.
Right.
So that's why we wanted to come together. We can learn about each other's culture and heritage and bring that to the forefront to the Capital Region, to people that, you know, whether they're from the West Indies or not.
So what's next? Real quick, and we'll close out. What's next for the Capital Region West Indian Association?
Well, we have a Sip and Paint coming up in June.
Sip and Paint.
That's
right.
Right
there.
So,
right, Alexis.
June 23rd.
Okay.
So we're hoping that you know, check us out on our Facebook page
All right.
For that event.
Mm-hmm.
So we're hoping people will come out and enjoy themselves. And
Yes, and well, we're also hoping to grow as an association. So we are looking for board members. If you want to join our association,
tell them real quick, please, we'll close out. How do they reach you then?
How do you reach us? You go on Facebook, Capital Region West Indian Association, or you can send us an email at capitalregionwia@gmail.com.
All right. Well, ladies, thank you so much. I know there's so much more we could talk about. We're going to have you back in the future. You are part of the WOOC family. Thank you. I appreciate everything that you do. This event is really going to be awesome. I've heard a lot of energy around it. Right. And God bless you and continued success in each and everything you do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Looking forward to hearing from you soon. Right. All right. So.
Now we're going to turn it over to roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry, reporting from the Schenectady County Public Library, where two statues were recently dedicated to honor Harriet Tubman and William Seward. So we're going to hear from Frank Wicks, founder and key organizers, Paul Seward, co-founder and director of the Underground Railroad History Project, Philip Fields, deputy chair of the Schenectady County Legislature, and Dexter Benedict, state sculptor.
Wow.
Meeting on the old campground. Now join us. Meeting tonight.
This is Willie Terry, the Roman labor correspondent for the Hustle Mohawk magazine. And I'm here in Schenectady on Friday, May 17th, at the unveiling of the statue of William Seward and Harriet Tubman at the Schenectady County Library. It was a great ceremony, a lot of speakers, and I'm going to try to get an interview with one of the key organizers and founder of this event.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm here at the Schenectady Library, and I have as one of my guests, one of the key organizers of this event today, Frank Witt. And Frank, it's been a long, hard struggle. And how do you feel today?
I feel wonderful. I point out there's a big idea, and then all the stars of the universe seem to have converged on Schenectady today. You know, this is absolutely wonderful. Well, 3 years ago, this was a very vague idea, but the people that got liked the idea was that we've got a statue with a story and a theme. The story of two unlikely people being friends, important people. The others, we got a theme of leaders, freedom, diversity, and friendship, all together.
So, Frank, you think it was more than what you expected?
It turned out far better than I expected. But one thing you have to be, the real motivator was talking to people along the way, and everyone liked the idea, but when I got done, they said, I didn't know that. And they say, that's a good reason to do it. So it's educational, so people didn't know it, not only get to know this, but learn other things.
Frank, tell me just a little about your two co-organizers.
The two other professors from Union College are Professor Twitty Stiles, and a real pioneer in Union College. In fact, he just wrote his autobiography of growing up in Farmville, Virginia. And he was born in 1927, so Twitty turns 92 tomorrow. So I have to. And the other is Professor Carl George, and the two of them were both in biology professors, but they teamed up 50 years ago to not only teach biology, but to make Union College a better place.
And Frank, you think that we're going to have like at least a little ceremony every year during this time just to, you know, make sure that people know what happened this day?
Yeah, that's important. In other words, you don't, I say it's like going to the moon. We had to get the statue made and placed here, but if people don't know about it, it's not, so this event's wonderful. You know, we're able to talk about, know about it. And this is your idea, not my idea, but it's a good idea. Every year we might have an anniversary ceremony here.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you, Frank, and congratulations.
Yeah. And I met you first at the Seward home, and then I met you at the conference over at Siena.
Right. And me and him talked, and I said, I'll be here.
And you're here.
And I'm here. Thank you, Frank.
You're here with Independent Media.
Independent Media. Thank you, Frank. Yeah, I'm here at the unveiling of the statue of William Seward and Harriet Tubman. And I have Paul Stewart here, who's a organizer of the Underground Railroad House in Albany. And Paul, I want to ask you, so what are your thoughts on this statue unveiling today?
Well, the whole program was wonderful today. It's exciting that there's this kind of recognition here. I think, obviously, Harriet Tubman deserves the recognition. William Seward for his work, too. And, of course, their friendship was important, and that's the occasion of the recognition here. So, hey, this is a wonderful event. Just can't say more about it than that.
So Harriet Tubman did come through Schenectady.
She came when she was going north. She would come up. One of the ways that she would come up through Albany and then through Schenectady on her way west. It was inevitable that she would have come through Schenectady. She was, you know, utilizing the transportation that was available, which in some cases was a train, in some cases was the Erie Canal. So, and I think that the friendship of Seward and Tubman beyond that, as I think was outlined in the presentations this morning, in Auburn, and Seward being from Union College and all in Schenectady, I think that's very, very important. So, yeah.
Now, did Harriet come by the Myers house in Albany?
Well, the Myers lived in a bunch of different places, and the place that has survived to us today, which we're calling the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence, I'm not so sure she ever stopped there.
But she did meet Stephen.
But she would have. She probably stayed with them at their location at 10 Lark Street and 168 Third Street. Of course, those buildings are no longer there. But she had a connection with the Myers.
Now, I know you heard about this story lately that was in the paper about they want to put Harriet on the $20 bill.
Yes, that was really an exciting development, not only because it was an honor for Harriet, but because it was an African-American who would have been replacing President Jackson. And President Jackson was well known for his role in removing Native American people from the eastern part of the country, as well as, you know, many other indicators of kind of him being on the side of oppression, if you will, a slaveholder himself, etc. So it would have been important justice for Harriet Tubman to replace him on the $5 bill, or the $20 bill. But unfortunately, it looks like that is either delayed or perhaps put off to a future moment. We hope that that's the case and that this will come to be eventually.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Paul.
Yeah.
Okay, I have as my guest one of the political representative in Schenectady, and he going to tell me who he is and what he do.
Thank you very much. My name is Philip Fields. I'm the deputy chair of the Schenectady County Legislature, and we're happy this morning to be gathered here for this unveiling of the new statute that's here with Harriet Tubman and William Seward. These people made a significant contribution to people right here in Schenectady, but also in New York State, United States as a whole, where we have William Tubman, who actually brought, you know, slaves, freed slaves from the South to the North, and established pasture these parts here in the Capital Region. And then we have William Seward, who was a Union College graduate, also became a senator for the state, a governor for the state, a U.S. senator, and also a secretary for the state under Abraham Lincoln, President Abraham Lincoln, and also President Johnson. And their lives connected together in a such unique way in Auburn, New York, where he actually grew up, and actually Mrs. Harriet Tubman has a property and a house that's down there on behalf of Mrs. Seward. And so here in Schenectady, we recognize that this relationship that's had there, where people, in a sense, sought to freedom, And he fought for the freedom, in a sense, on the legislative side, and also in the governmental side. We are celebrating today the statute, so people, the children of the future, tomorrow, can actually see a little bit of history, understood what took place, and look at these two people, two different colors, working together to make our lives better today. Everyone is invited to come down here and take a look and see what's taking place here in Schenectady, downtown, right in front of the library. As we heard today, Harriet Tubman, it's significant that she's here. She was a literate person, and now her picture and her statue, it's right in front of a place where people can learn and understand history and understand how they can make lives better for themselves. And so we're glad that this opportunity is here for everyone in Schenectady, and everyone around the states and around the country can come and visit and look.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
All right, now.
Okay.
And I'm here with the sculpture of the statue, Harriet Tubman and William Seward. What's your name?
Dexter Benedict.
Let me ask you, how long did it take you to do this project?
Well, longer than it should have. The studio burned down and we lost the pieces, but about 7 months this time around. Once we got the studio built and started working again, it took about 7 months to pull it together.
Right.
To model it in clay and then go through the casting process.
Mm-hmm. So how do you feel about this day?
Oh, this is a great day. Really nice to hear what was said in the presentation, and then the enthusiasm of people once it was unveiled is very gratifying, and they are heroes.
Right. And you know your sculpture is going to be here for a lifetime.
Longer than me.
Right.
Yes, no, I'm very pleased with the site and the opportunity that Frank and the committee extended to me to make them.
Right. Do you have other sculptures around?
I do. Well, there's Steinmetz and Edison down on Erie Boulevard, of course. That was a couple of years ago. And then there's one in Florida, and there are numerous ones in Rochester and Syracuse. So I've been in Jamestown, so I've been busy. There's one, a portrait bust of Robert Jackson in the Supreme Court in Washington, so... I've had the opportunity to, as I had said earlier, to make heroes, images of heroes.
Right. So,
well, I think that, as Frank said, he wanted to point to the historical aspect of these important people, but also to make a contemporary statement about where we're going.
Right.
And I think that's was in my mind and in the process as well, to try and accomplish that.
Right. And one of the key things I didn't know, and everybody was surprised about the gun.
Yeah.
Now, how did you get that in there?
Well, I didn't want the gun to be prominent, so I thought, well, I'll tuck it into her tote bag, you know, and with the barrel. Because historians, someone would come up and say, I thought she carried a revolver. And I say, yeah, she does. It's right in her bag, sitting on her cheese sandwich.
Right. Okay.
So, I just didn't want the gun to be the main event, because sometimes people might fixate on that. I wanted to see her staff. I wanted to see her moving forward and Seward giving support to her. So I sort of underplayed the revolver. Right. Yeah, very good.
Okay, so thank you again.
Well, thank you. Nice to talk with you.
All right, now.
Yeah, bye now.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Terry, for another great, great segment. All right.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And I'm H. Bosch Jr. All right. I'm H. Bosch Jr. And you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out at mediasanctuary.org. And if you have comments, suggestions, or a genuine photo of a Snorlax, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And don't forget to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. And next up, we have a segment on a new art show opening at Collar Works in Troy that starts tomorrow, Friday, May 31st.
I'm Elizabeth Press, and this is not Collar Works Radio, but we are joined by the curators of a show that is opening up at Collar Works this Friday, May 31st. The show is Art Stands Still, and it's curated by Natalie Fleming and Van Tran Nguyen. Welcome, you two, to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Thanks for joining us today. Van here in the studio and Natalie remotely. Where are you, Natalie?
I am in Brewster, New York, so not too far away.
So let's just jump right in. Art Stands Still. How'd you get this name, and what is this show all about?
Well, this show came out of another project that Van and I collaborated on 2 years ago, an exhibition in Buffalo, New York, called Forging American Art, which was a show that focused on Asian American art in the Rust Belt. And while we were working on that show, one theme that came out of that show was about labor and the way in which we talk about labor and value our labor. And so while we were working on that show, we were already coming up with our new one. One thing that Van and I are always constantly working on a project, we're moving from one thing to another, and we are interested in rethinking we are living vicariously in the show a little bit, thinking about what alternatives for us, for other people would be if we re-looked at the way in which we define progress and productivity and success, and what would it mean if we just stood still for a little bit and stopped moving.
So why now? Why Troy? And with the artists that you include in the show, what are some of the common themes that are emerging?
So for example, actually one of the works in the show that we were drawn to in already thinking about this before we even had the chance to land this location of installing it at Colorworks and working with Colorworks is an artist from Buffalo. Actually, his name is Paul Venus, who was a professor of mine, and he made this work that was all about labor and looking at these specific types of bacteria that emit the smell of labor and what it would look like if he were to display work without work, or signs of work without work. And we were really interested in that idea as one of the symptoms or symbols of what it looks like to rethink work and to rethink progress. So that was one of the central themes, actually, in our show is thinking about refusal of work. Like, what would it look like if we stood still, laid down, you know, in the midst of all of this progress and in the midst of all of this, like, rapid movement around us? What would it look like if you just stood still? And we thought of that as a sign or a symbol of resistance and also a central theme in the show.
I mean, for us, Colorworks is the perfect location because, of course, it was born out of an old factory in Troy. And I think particularly now in places like Troy, which were known for their industrial centers, we're rethinking what the future is for these places. And so that's why this is the perfect location. Why now? Well, as many of us are very well aware, Americans are more productive than they ever have been, yet our wages are more or less stagnant. There's more and more money at the top, but it's not getting down to everybody else. So once you see things like that, you realize that there's a problem with the way in which we are defining the direction we're going in. And these artists, through the themes that emerge, are allowing for us to rethink some of the ways in which we've defined what a life should look like and the direction it should go in.
As the co-curators of this show, how do you decide? Who else is in the show? You've mentioned a couple people, but
There's a lot of great artists in the show. Van and I always have a few artists in mind, and then we're also putting a call out to everyone. Because you never know what you're going to get, and we're always surprised, pleasantly surprised by what comes in. When we're making a show, we're always looking at local artists. For example, we have a lot of artists from the Troy community and then just right outside. Van mentioned Paul Venus, but also Mike Yude, Kurt Treby, Sylvia Rodanka. These are all artists from this community. And then we look for artists that we can bring in for something new as well. So, for example, we have Regina Jose Galindo, who is an internationally known artist, famous for her work in the Venice Biennale. We have artists from all over. I went down to Baltimore to pick up one of our biggest works by James Mayhew, which everyone should go check out. It's mm-hmm. this giant bed that's really quite spectacular to see in person.
Yes, and also to add to that, Emily Vey Duke and Cooper's Battersby of Duke and Battersby are currently at the Venice Biennale premiering a video that they have loaned to us that it will be at the exhibition as well, called You Were in Amazement, The Day You Were Born. So we have been super lucky to work with such great artists near and far to bring together this really great exhibition. And so if you are free on Friday, please come on down.
And just to stay on that for a minute, it's not just Friday, but right. Friday there is an opening from 5 to 8 p.m.?
Yes, Friday, the official opening, there will be food and refreshments at this opening from 5 to 8 p.m. at Collarworks. But then,
and also, sorry, just to mention, we also have a performance that will be taking place on Friday and only Friday by a Buffalo-based artist, Brandon Geisman.
Yes, and then on Saturday as well, there is a Collarworks-sponsored event, but it is a ticketed event, and it is called Collared Greens, and it's a dinner and dialogue event from 6 to 9, where we will have a few select artists from the show that will be there, and you can talk to us and you can talk to the artists about work that they are thinking about, and the dinner will take place in the gallery. So it'll be something fun and interesting if you are available on Saturday.
So just before we wrap up, I hear there's performance, there's video, there's installation. Any other specialties that we should look out for? Does Sylvia have a security camera?
Yes, she has. Well, she doesn't have a security camera. She has an insecurity camera. So Sylvia's work, which actually will greet you when you enter, it's called the insecurity camera, and it is essentially a camera that is shy. So, you know, she plays, it's a lot of wordplay, camera shy, and it's a security cam that avoids human contact. When you come in, you'll be greeted with this insecurity camera. So yeah, it's a little something for everyone. And that's usually what our projects or curatorial projects strive for. But yes, there will be a wacky camera.
And we're quickly running out of time. Is there anything that either of you would like to add before we part ways?
Well, that the show runs until July 13th. So even if you are not available this Friday and Saturday, please still, if you have the time to come see it, it'll be open for another month.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining me today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And don't forget to check out Art Stand Still, opening this Friday, May 31st, from 5 to 8 p.m. is the opening reception at Collarworks. Do you know the address of Collarworks off the top of your head?
I do.
I do. It's 621 River Street in Troy. So thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next up is roaming correspondent Willie Terry attended a forum hosted by the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, entitled Red State Revolt, with author Eric Blanc speaking about the teacher strike wave and working class politics. This event took place at New York State Nursing Association office in Albany, New York on May 14th. In his segment, you will hear excerpts from Eric Blanc's speech about his book, Red State Revolt.
This is Willie Terry, your Roman labor correspondent for the Hustle Mohawk magazine. And I'm here in Albany at a forum entitled Red State Revolt. And the speaker is Eric Blanc, and I have him right here in front of me. How you doing, Eric?
I'm great. Thanks for talking.
All right. So, Eric, tell me just a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I was a teacher for 8 years in the Bay Area. I've been a public education organizer and an activist for a long time, and I spent the last year and a half traveling around covering the teacher strikes that have popped off across the country. I've been in every single one of the big strikes, writing about it, and also helping organize national support for them.
Okay, and not only that, I see you got a book called The Red State Revolt. Just tell me just a little bit about that book.
Yeah, the book just came out. It's about the 2018 statewide teacher strikes in West Virginia, Oklahoma, and Arizona, where I was at. And it's really trying to draw some of the big lessons about these strikes and also to really highlight how important they are for national politics.
So how could one get a copy of your book?
Yeah, it's online. If you go to Amazon or just Google it, you know, there's a lot of different ways to buy it online. And it should be in various different local bookstores as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, what motivated you to write a book, though?
Well, I mean, the wave of teacher strikes that has popped off in the last years, the highest number of strikes total in the United States for decades. Uh-huh. It's really a game changer. For the first time in a really long time, organized labor is fighting back. It's showing it can win, and it's bringing back the tactic and weapon of the strike, which has been largely abandoned by labor. And so it's a really exciting time, I think, to be a teacher, to be a labor activist, and to feel like, you know, we can turn things around.
So you feel that the teachers have taken the lead?
Yeah, I think it's really clear. You know, the overwhelming majority of workers who went on strike last year were teachers, and I think other, you know, other workers across the country are looking and seeing them win and are getting inspired by their example.
Why was it that teachers took it on first? You know, you would look like it might be the maybe the auto workers or some truck drivers or some state workers.
That's a really good question. I think part of it is that there's been a really concerted offensive against public education over the last 10, 20 years. So the types of conditions in schools have really deteriorated. So the expectations that teachers had to be able to do their job in an effective way, to be able to actually teach students, has been just so hampered by the underfunding, by the corporate education reform that's just pushing standardized testing, by the privatization. All of these things have made it so that teachers really feel that they can't do their job in the way they used to.
Now, was Chicago the first area where that was a major teacher strike and a successful strike?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so 2012 was really, in some ways, the opening shot of what we're currently seeing. In 2012, there was a big citywide strike in Chicago of the teachers, and it really reflected the type of politics we're seeing now in these more recent strikes, which was teachers' unions fighting not just for their own members, but for parents and students as a whole, really bringing back the strike, willing to challenge not just the Republicans, but also the Democrats. Yeah, it really set the parameter for what labor action could be in the current context.
Mm-hmm. Now, in this era of what they're doing, is it a continuing process, or did it end after the strike, or are they continually doing things to organize the labor movement?
Yeah, the strikes haven't stopped at all. In fact, there's been multiple major strikes just this last year, Los Angeles, Oakland, Sacramento, Denver. Las Vegas teachers just authorized a strike. There was South Carolina, North Carolina had mass protests and walkouts. So did Oregon just in the last couple of weeks. So the teachers' strike wave is continuing. There's no sign that it's going to end anytime soon.
Well, we need to build a labor movement, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think teachers are pointing the way.
All right. Thank you, Eric, and I look forward to your presentation.
Great. Thanks so much. Thanks so much to all of you for coming and to the organizers for having me. And it's what I want to do is briefly lay out why the strikes are so important. That's the first part. And then second, some of the big lessons from the strikes. See this dramatic increase in 2018. Almost 400,000 teachers and education workers struck in 2018. So this is unprecedented as far as the education sector goes. Well, and a really major aspect of why these strikes were so important is also that they were statewide and they were really, really big. And so this is very interesting because 2018 actually had the largest average size of strikes in the history of the United States. But yeah, on average, over 24,000 workers struck in an average of the strikes last year. And the reason that's significant is that the strikes weren't just numerous workers involved, but they were so big and powerful, they were statewide, they broke the law, they brought in community members 18. And so the strikes that happened, beginning in West Virginia, were statewide for the most part, and in order to make that happen, they had to break the law, and we'll get back to that, but that was a significant aspect. So they were able to kind of break out of the confines of the existing labor regime in the United States, which makes us generally bargain in the narrowest possible terrain, which is why we're kind of set up to lose. There was two other industries that struck in significant numbers and fitting. Yes, nurses are one, and there's one other. There's significant strikes in hotels. And one of the big similarities then of these three industries, you can think of various ones, but the one that I think is most striking is that these are overwhelmingly female workforces. Mm-hmm. So you really have a labor movement and a strike wave that's led by women workers, and that's really exciting. And it looks different. It means the working class and the labor movement, you know, it looks different than it did before, and we should be happy about it. We should just celebrate that. But just taking a step back, one of the reasons the strikes are so, you know, historically significant is that they won a lot, too. Our side has been getting really pummeled for the last 40 years in a one-sided class war the billionaires have subjected us to. And for the first time in a very long time, the labor movement has started to fight back and win, right? And we've been faced with this neoliberal offensive that was mentioned earlier, and the strikes have posed a possibility of beginning to turn the tide on that. And that's the ultimate historic significance of this, is that for the first time, people get a sense of their own power. And part of that is the strikes won, and then when you see a strike win, then you say, oh, why can't we do the same thing? And, you know, just to give a brief overview, in places like Arizona, which is far from a progressive or even liberal bastion, they got 20% pay raises for educators. They defeated privatization schemes. They were able to get more funding for students. In West Virginia, they were able to defeat privatization attempts, get a 5% raise for all public employees. They defeated an attempt to double their healthcare costs for all public employees in the state. And the list goes on. Los Angeles, as was mentioned earlier, went even further. They dramatically lowered class sizes. They won more nurses and counselors in the schools. You know, so not only did the strikes prevent bad things from happening, but they actually began to turn the tide and start winning back some of the rights that we've lost over these years. So that's a significant aspect. A second significant aspect is just how many people, and again, this was mentioned earlier, were transformed by these events. You're talking about literally hundreds of thousands of teachers who participated, but for every teacher, you have dozens of students, if not more, and you have, in total, you're talking about millions of students and millions of family members who were affected and participated in the strikes. And these strikes were transformative events. People described them an almost religious experience, you know, where you go and you're surrounded by tens of thousands of your coworkers who all of a sudden become your friends and will house you for the evening, they will feed you, and you're engaging in a collective action and a real risk together with them. And that sense of powerlessness and individual isolation that really constrains our day-to-day lives and really, you know, marks our day-to-day lives, almost overnight, because of the power of these strikes and the being at the Capitol and where everyone's chanting and wearing red, really changed people's lives for good. And that was one of the things that, you know, talks about in the book, just how many people went through this experience and changed radically how they related to their coworkers, how they related to their community, and just how they felt about themselves as agents for change. And I thought the most inspiring aspect of it was not just the organizers, but people who had never gone to a union meeting before, people who had never been involved in anything, and who sometimes just the day before were still skeptical, but then who in the process of the walkout itself sometimes became the most militant and became the people who didn't want to go back at the end, and who, you know, got a taste of power and was like, didn't want to go back to the way things were. So there's a transformation of the people that participate, and there's also a transformation of public consciousness around the crisis of public education. So yeah, as was mentioned earlier, the dominant discourse, as I'm sure you all know, has been for years around education, like in other public sector work, that the crisis of schools is because of unions, right? Greedy unions, lazy teachers, and the inherent inefficiencies of the public sector. So you gotta bring in the private sector and market competition and all of the genius of capital to make our schools work. And so because the strike wave forced a change in the political conversation, it made it clear that the overwhelming majority of the public actually supports teachers. According to the national polls, you have 75 to 78% of the public supports the teachers' strikes and their demands. That's huge. And that's not just national. It's not just in blue states. In places like Oklahoma and Arizona, the numbers were the same. So what you're talking about is actually like a really deep sentiment in favor of public education and against the type of corporate myth-making that has been dominant, not just with Republicans, but under Democrats as well. The significance then is that it changed people's own sense of power, it won major gains, and it led to a transformation of the national political conversation.
And thank you to Willie Terry for reporting from the Democratic Socialists of America's Forum, Red State Revolt.
Okay, that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Our engineer tonight is Felix McGuy.
Felix!
Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. And you can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine Facebook and podcast page. If you have questions, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And don't forget to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, Hudson Mohawk Radio Network is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings held right here Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr. Thank you for tuning in.